Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, hope everybody is enjoying the absolute best month of the year, October. We are now, it's hard to believe, halfway through October, which seems crazy, but I just love this month, this weekend coming up. The weather, we have like a cold front coming in, and it's going to really just like be the perfect fall weather weekend.
Time for hot chocolate.
Yes.
And some bonfires.
That sounds good.
Some hot chocolate, some bonfires, and we've... This may have been since we did the last podcast that we did s'mores and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Which is what we like to do during the...
Yeah.
During the fall, so...
So tomorrow, we're actually going to the Tennessee Ole Miss game. We are... We have opened up our hearts to be broken again. And...
It's the hope that kills you.
Exactly.
Isn't that what they say on Ted Lasso?
Maybe so.
Yeah, it's the hope that kills you.
Yeah, so we are super excited about that. And honestly, part of the reason we're recording the podcast tonight is because I know that Sunday, Garrett's voice will be gone. And so we couldn't record.
Provided that the game lasts longer than the fourth quarter.
Assuming the first half, at least, is like a game.
Yeah.
Garrett's voice will be gone. He has always lost his voice like... On retreats with the, you know, like if we've gone with the youth group or, anything where we're singing. And then Garrett usually gets the role of like, hey, lead this yell chant thing, you know, or.
Not at football games.
No, not at football games.
They have designated people for that at football games that nobody actually listens to.
You look over them.
I don't even know what their purpose is.
They're trying to get our attention.
Yeah.
But, but for some reason you are always one to yell thing. I mean, I don't want to give anything.
I don't know what you're talking about right now.
Well, like that one song that we used to sing like
in
and stuff. And then, what is the Ooga Booga?
Yeah, doing Ooga Booga.
Which, you know, not that most people probably are like, well, I don't know what that means, but it involves a lot of yelling by Garrett. That's all I can really tell you about that.
Melissa's point is that if it involves yelling, then Garrett is the one.
In the heart of it, you know? He loses his voice often, and so we needed to record. At the same time, we need to be drinking lots of water so that he still has a voice for tomorrow.
Yeah.
We've got to have our voices, our lungs at full capacity to bring home the W. Yeah, right.
I don't really believe any of that's ever going to happen. So.
No.
Basically,
but anyway.
We've come home with enough sad drives from Tennessee football games that I've...
We're ready to live through it.
I've given up all hope that anything... Fun can actually happen.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the atmosphere is going to be really fun and good and everything. So
yeah, the atmosphere will be awesome.
We're excited about it.
Yeah.
We have one little silly...
Well, we're going to do questions.
Yeah.
And we have one leading question. It's just one of the questions.
Okay.
It's not a separate segment.
It's not a story.
It's not a separate segment.
Okay.
It's just a Caleb asked us a very serious question that we wanted to make sure that we...
In the car.
We addressed with everybody.
He needed us to like stop talking to each other so that he could ask this question.
Had a lot of deep impacts on it. I was like, man, this kid is really thinking whenever he asked me this question. And from the back seat, as we were on our way, were we on our way to Chick-fil-A?
I don't know.
I mean, just deep, really deep question. I mean, just really thinking hard, you know, and I'm thinking like maybe all of my discussions with him at bedtime are really starting to come through to him. And he asked this question. He said, are boogers brains? And I just thought that was so profound. It was like, wow, I've never asked myself that question before.
Really
and I tell you, like, I really try hard to really question everything, you know, and be like, okay, have I ever asked myself this question before? And I have never asked the question, are boogers brains?
It's true. And I
do you have a thought on this?
Well, I don't really have a thought on the answer.
Yeah.
I can kind of see based off pictures why he might have thought that.
Yeah.
Or assume that the answer would be yes, they are, when in fact they are not. But the only thing I could think of as to why he asked that is because he had been COVID tested twice this week. Cause he was like contact trace from school. And so I think just like those sticks going in, and we kind of always joke around.
He starts thinking about scratching your brain.
Joke that they can scratch your brain with those things, that he's like, oh my goodness, these things are actually connected.
Well, if you just really sit back and think about it, you know, as a kid or
gravity,
maybe an ancient Israelite, you know, you're like, where in the world do these things come from? They just appear, you know, in my nose.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and they look kind of like what it looks like whenever, you know, somebody's head gets splattered everywhere, you know, so they kind of look like that. So maybe whenever we're picking our boogers, it's actually... It's intuitive. It really is. It's intuitive. If I'm reaching up into my, like, skull and pulling out this thing that's slimy and...
That maybe it comes from there. Yeah.
And it's got, like, a consistency to it, just, like, kind of squishy like a brain.
Yeah.
What's in your head.
Yeah, I mean...
And so it seems to make sense that, like, if you were just trying to randomly deduce where do boogers come from... It would say, actually, it falls down from your brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's excess brain matter.
Excess brain matter.
So that's why it's very intuitive.
In
it's
all
a very
seriousness, though, Caleb really does ask some, like... I mean, the other day he asked me, where is heaven? Like, he will ask some serious, like, deep questions. And they are sometimes really challenging to answer. And I'm so glad, honestly, a lot of our studying together and doing these podcasts have really helped me to be able to give him more meaningful answers.
Yeah.
And answers that I can have like, yes, this is what I know for sure. This is what I actually believe. And not just trying to like come up with, what do I really think about that on the whim?
Right.
And not that I have all the answers for him. And sometimes I tell him that we don't know everything and it's okay that we don't know everything. But I mean, it's definitely helped to be digging the way we have been.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
All right. So second question.
Second question is from our don't scratch through, ask those questions.
Yeah.
And so the question that we have today is, what is a talent God has given you and how are you using it?
Okay.
So you want to answer that? We're both going to answer this. Do you want to answer it first?
Well, I mean, I think that I have a naturally, you know, or one talent that I have is I'm naturally inquisitive. Like, and I love to dig and learn and, you know, like I feel like I'm able to see things like, maybe, I don't know how to necessarily put this, but like what we're saying, like asking questions that maybe you always assumed, like you just always assume something behind it. And you're kind of revealing like, hey, we never really thought about this before. And we've never really questioned this before. We just go on singing this type of thing. Like I just taught a class, at East Brainerd that I call the name of the Lord. And if you just think about it, like throughout all kinds of, you know, if you've spent any time in church, you know, you've heard people sing, you've sang something about the name of God or in the name of Jesus and all these things. And, you know, and I just stopped to think like, what does this even mean whenever we say this? Because I think that there was more to it. And so I was able to take my talents are to like be able to then do research and think deeply about things and try to understand maybe stuff that we've taken for granted. And then try to, relay that to someone else to try to help them understand it. I think I'm decent at communication, you know, like I want to like at trying to relay thoughts from one person to another. And so for me, I mean, this right here is how I feel like I use my talents is that I read and I research and I try to regurgitate that for other people to help them understand who God is. as I'm learning who God is, and then, you know, then maybe help people grow deeper with Him. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, that's probably the talent I'm using most often, I suppose, of like just being able to take something and kind of tear it apart and learn about it and research it and then relay that information to somebody else to help them. So what about you?
So I think, and I might have talked a little bit about this before on here, but I do much better like in a one-on-one setting versus like, which Garrett does really well with both one-on-one or with like speaking in front of a group of people, maybe not like 300. I mean like a group of 10, like, right. You know, that he has a lot of experience with that, with work and with like teaching classes and stuff at our church. And so, but for me, I very much have honed in more on like, it's hard for me to feel natural being an open and honest with like in a group setting. But man, I can really be raw and like vulnerable and open and honest about my feelings or what I'm going through or what I've been through in the past when it's a one-on-one conversation. And mm-hmm. So I have had an opportunity to, and I really think I've put myself out on a limb, been willing to put myself out on a limb to make more one-on-one connections or friendships with people. And when I do that, I'm not afraid to tell them really whatever. I mean, I really think that when I have like, once I have like a one-on-one like relationship with somebody, I will tell them almost anything. Like mm-hmm. I am very much like an open book. And so I think that has, I've been able to help others in ways with like my experiences as a mom or, I don't know, just anything, you know, anything that we've talked about on here that I've gone through. And honestly, not only that, but doing the podcast and trying to make it be a conversation between me and you, me and mm-hmm. Garrett, it's like allows me to kind of tap into that.
Right.
And still like reach more numbers, if right. you will. Like, right. Not, I'm not having to stand in front of a bunch of people and do this because I don't know that I could or would.
Right.
Even the exact same things that I'm talking about on the podcast, I don't know if I could do that if 10 listeners were in the room with us right now.
Right. It kind of creates the feeling as if you're not talking to a bunch of people.
Right.
That, you know, it is that one, you get that one-on-one feel. Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think I've been pretty honest on here. Obviously, you know, you're recording something that is going on the internet for all time. So you're a little bit more aware than you might would be if you were going on a walk with a friend and you're, you know, talking through things.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of, mm-hmm. I don't know, one of my major strengths is like, having conversations with people one-on-one and really trying to get to know them and like understand them and also them like getting to know me
through those one-on-one conversations. And a friend of mine, I was talking through some things with him and I was just noting, or we were both noting, it was like, what are the things that you remember like that helped you in your faith the most? And it's not really like you know, usually for things like that, it's not like I didn't come to faith in Jesus because of an intellectual argument. You know, like mm-hmm. I came to faith in Jesus because of how people treated me and how people in one-on-one relationships may be important.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that you do, is that you make people important and they feel like they're important, you know, to you. And that changes people, you know, for that. And I think that is like, I feel like that's a much more important part of what it is to be a Jesus follower than it is to just be somebody that stands up and talks to a bunch of people. Because, I mean, again, there's only maybe a handful of things, you know, like sermons or whatever that I can remember, you know, that I'm like, oh yeah, that one changed my life, you know, like that. The things that changed my life were individual people that interjected themselves in my life and changed it.
Yeah.
You know, so like that to me is, it seems to be a a more important talent, if you will, you know, to be that person that's able to better be one-on-one. I think I'm kind of realizing, like, I actually have a harder time, like, getting to know somebody one-on-one, you know, for the first time. Yeah. Especially, like, we've been, you know, we moved to a new neighborhood. We talked about that before. And you've been better at getting to know people than I have. And I think that you probably always saw me as the extrovert.
Well, I mean, and you are.
Yeah.
But not in this sense.
Yeah. But I have a hard time, like, getting out there and talking one-on-one with our neighbors, whereas you have been much more for that.
To be honest, that's not something that's always been me.
Yeah.
And I think I've come into recognizing this, I guess, talent. What I'm going to consider a talent now. Within, like, the last year or so.
Well, I don't think the point in the question is that you're, like, good at juggling or something like that, you know. Which you are, actually.
With a soccer ball. Not the clowns juggling. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess that would be it. It's hard because this question is tough to talk about without feeling like you're just...
bragging on yourself?
Right.
Yeah.
So... because honestly, pretty much all of my quote unquote talents, I could also say, and I think this is probably true for Garrett too, is that, sometimes I feel so confident in them. And then 24 hours later, I feel like I'm the worst at it ever.
Yeah. You're 24 hours later. I'm like 5 minutes later. And so whatever I talk about, like, whatever regurgitating, you know, information and stuff like that, I'm always like, I feel like I'm utter failure at that. Mm-hmm. It takes so much encouragement for me, you know, like, to feel like, okay, you did do okay at this, you know.
Because, like, even in my quote-unquote talent of, like, talking to other people, I always leave the conversation going, ooh, did I make that awkward? Like, you know, don't know if I said all that right. So I second guess even within what I would maybe consider to be my talent.
Yeah.
But also just even, I think too, of being a mom, I'm like, I am the only person who can raise Caleb and Sadie. No one can do it like me. And then at the same time, I tell Garrett every day, like, I am failing as a mom. I'm doing awful. Like, Caleb watched so much TV today, like, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just, boy, it's a trip.
Yeah. Yeah. So we will transition into Habakkuk now. Just a little recap. Habakkuk, we got three whole chapters of the book of Habakkuk. That is a series of, well, really the last two chapters has been a series of complaints from the prophet to God. He's addressing directly God, and this is in a time whenever Judah is about to fall and Assyria is about to fall to Babylon, but Habakkuk is crying out saying, like, why, God, do you allow, you know, violence to continue? Why do you allow people to do, you know, terrible things to each other? And I cry out to you and nothing happens and nothing changes. It doesn't seem consistent. And he's crying out to God, and God's answer is, I'm sending the Babylonians. And Habakkuk's answer to that is, like, that seems like a bad idea. That seems worse than the situation I'm already in. In the last chapter, chapter two, was God's response to Habakkuk about Babylon and really about any subsequent nation that makes its, you know, that builds itself in the way that Babylon does, you know, of violence and power and might and its strength is its sword type thing.
Taking
advantage of other people to gain power and amass wealth and all this stuff and pushing down the poor. You know, so his answer to Habakkuk is that I am the God who takes care of that, and I will. The last part of chapter two, let me pull this up here, and there was an awesome line in there, where it kind of, to me, it encapsulates, like, the entire story of the Bible and what God is trying to do is like, and it says in chapter 2, verse 14, it says, "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh, like the waters covers the sea." And we talked about that. And I think that's really like the whole goal of the whole Bible is God's glory filling the entirety of his creation, the way that the waters covers the sea. And we talked a little bit about that. But he ends chapter 2 with kind of mocking idols and, you know, how you speak to these, you know, these wooden things saying, wake up, and they can't do anything. But whenever you consider Yahweh in his holy temple, all the earth will be silent before him. And so he's kind of in awe of Yahweh and who he is. And so it's the first two chapters are definitely, or the whole book of Habakkuk is this kind of lament song. And I thought that this was really good, and I wanted to read it. This is by a guy, he's a Old Testament scholar named Walter Brueggemann. And he talks about the lament psalms and how we don't really, or any of the songs of a lament in the Bible, and how we don't really, we don't give them the credit that they're due. And we tend to just try to move from, you know, tragedy into, you know, hey, be happy all the time. Like, we don't really ever give room for lament. He says this: "It is clear that a church that goes on singing happy songs in the face of raw reality is doing something very different from what the Bible itself does. I think that serious religious use of the lament songs has been minimal because we have believed that faith does not mean to acknowledge and embrace negativity. We have thought that acknowledgement of negativity was somehow to act an act of unfaith, as though the very speech about it conceded too much about God's loss of control. The point is to be urged here. The point to be urged here is this: the use of these psalms of darkness may be judged by the world to be acts of unfaith and failure, but for the trusting community, their use is an act of bold faith, albeit a transformed faith. It is an act of bold faith on the one hand because it insists that the world must be experienced as it really is and not in some pretended way. On the other hand, it is bold because it insists that all such experiences of disorder are a proper subject for discourse with God. There is nothing out of bounds, nothing precluded of inappropriate. Everything properly belongs in this conversation of the heart. To withhold parts of life from that conversation is in fact to withhold part of life from the sovereignty of God. Thus, these psalms make the important connection. Everything must be brought to speech, and everything brought to speech must be addressed to God, who is the final reference for all life." And so his point isn't that, hey, you know, like, don't rejoice. His point is that we don't really give a time in the middle between tragedy and recognizing who God is and rejoicing, that we don't allow for that lament and to say, hey, God, what's up? And it's actually an act of faith to say, this doesn't seem consistent with what you want the world to be and who you are. And I think that that's important for us to recognize of that, hey, you know, this isn't even saying I don't understand and that I'm even doubting in this moment or what's going on is not an act of unfaith. It's actually an act of faith in saying, no, I believe that God is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loyal love and faithfulness. So what's up? You know, it's like this questioning of like, you've said you're this way, so why is the world looking this way, you know, this other way? And so I want to take Walter Brueggemann's challenge there to just be like, okay. And I think I talked mostly about this in the first chapter of saying it's okay to allow lamentation to be something that we do, and we need to do more of it. And I think that the world looks at us and says, why aren't you? You know, why aren't you lamenting these situations? Why do you just pretend that everything should just be happy all the time? And yes, we can have that. We can have that rejoicing because we know that Jesus is the Messiah and he's king of everything. But at the same time, we should allow for the grief as well, like we talked about, that we can hold joy and grief at the same time. You know, let's not just pretend that grief doesn't exist. And so anyways, that's kind of what this book is doing. And it's trying to get into that and trying to reveal that, hey, the Bible isn't just like thinking that everybody should just be happy all the time. That actually the prophets were very distressed a lot for what they were seeing. And so we're going to continue with this of like, so now what is Habakkuk's reaction to hearing that or to this this proclamation that, look, Babylon's end, and any nation that behaves like Babylon, its end is already written. So now what is Habakkuk's answer to that? So you want to start reading the beginning here?
A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth. Lord, I have heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds, O Lord. Renew them in our day, in our time make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. Selah.
So the beginning here is, it's interesting. This is, it's a really weird word, Shigionoth, if you've got that in your Bibles.
Maybe Shigionoth.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe pronounce it different.
So this is now Habakkuk's prayer. And, John Golden Gay translates that as, on laments. So and that's kind of why I wanted to lead with the lament stuff of like, and that, I guess it's also possible that it's like a stringed instrument or something like that, or some sort of instrument to be played on, that this song that it's about to follow is to be played on. But he essentially starts with this, you know, I've heard the report of you, and I stand in awe of your works. In the midst of the years, revive it. So what he's saying is that I've heard who you are. You know, I know who you've been. And his plea to God and his prayer to God is that he do it again. And so the question is, do what again? You know, like, what is the report that he's heard? And what is it that what are the works that Yahweh's done that he wants to have revived in his day? I love this little line right there at the end of 2. In wrath, may you remember to show compassion. And I think that's a little hint at what's about to come. And then you get a little bit more of that, of God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. These two places are around the area of Edom, which is where you would have Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. So what has ever happened where in wrath God showed compassion and came from in the area of Sinai? What story have I ever heard about like that, you know, which would be
Exodus.
The Exodus story. There you go. And this is going to be continual throughout all of the scriptures. They're going to do things like this. But he's remembering some works of God. I'm betting it's going to be the Exodus because of how this is.
Seems like a lot of things point back
to Exodus. Absolutely. I would almost say like every book seems to point back to Exodus in one way or another. And so he says, do it again. What you've done, do it again. And so now he's going to reflect on what those works were. And so he says, his splendor covers the heavens, and his praise fills the earth. And his brightness was like the light. Flashing rays came from his hand for him. And there is the covering of his strength. Before him went disease and pestilence went out at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. Then the mountains of old were shattered. The hills of old collapsed, and the ways of old belonged to him. Under affliction, I saw the tents of Cushan. The tent curtains of the land of Midian trembled. Was the anger of Yahweh against the rivers? Was your wrath against the rivers, or your fury against the sea, when you mounted upon your horses, upon your victory chariot? You laid bare the nakedness of your bow, swearing oaths with arrows of your word. You split the earth with rivers. When the mountains saw you, they writhed. A torrent of water swept by. The deep gave its voice, and it raised its hands on high. Sun and moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows, they moved about. At the gleam of the flashing of your spear, in fury you marched through the earth. In anger, you trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of wickedness, laying bare from the foundations to the top.
All right, so when we first read this, really, honestly, we already said it, but my mind went, there were some key words here that took my mind back to Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
And those words would be like, were you angry with the rivers? And I was thinking about the parting of the Red Sea through 8 and 9 and 10, really. So I was thinking that was the first thing that really stuck out to me. And then when we kind of read back through it a second time, just seeing the word plague, obviously that then triggered something with me. Probably should have triggered it the first reading, but seeing that big section on
the rivers and
everything kind of clued me into, oh, okay, we might be kind of thinking back to the Exodus story. Just all these things kind of, and I was thinking like, where is Cushan and Midian? And then we had kind of talked about like Garrett reminded me that Moses's wife was Midian. So like, where have I heard that before?
Right.
So like, you know, you're kind of thinking about these lands that are around.
Yeah. These are actually two peoples that come up in the book of Numbers as they're going through the wilderness. So the Midianites are one group and from Cushan, and there ends up being altercations with both of them. But so they're being recalled here as peoples that, you know, that saw repercussions to the Exodus narrative, you know, of the things that happen as they're making their way through the wilderness. But like here at the beginning of it, of like his splendor fills the heavens and his praise fills the earth. This is the way that biblical authors talk about the entirety of the cosmos. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the way that Hebrew authors are going to talk about all of God's creation, all of the cosmos, as you would say, the heavens and the earth. So it's like God fills out the whole of the world. It's taking you back to the Genesis 1 narrative. Brightness was like the light. This is, again, the flashing rays came from his hand. And then we get to the Exodus narrative of the disease and the pestilence going out from his feet. What's cool to me, so the mountains of old were shattered. The hills of old collapsed. So in their mind, you know, the hills and the mountains, they would be like the most stable thing that you could picture. Like these things, the mountains don't change in a lifetime. You know, like they stay the same. As far as they're concerned, the mountains don't change. And so in comparison, you know, or whenever they're confronted with Yahweh, even these things aren't stable compared to him, you know, and that they run from him type thing. And this whole narrative about the horses and whatnot, this is from Erdman's Companion of the Bible. It says verses 8 through 15 portray God as the chariot riding, spear wielding divine warrior who defeats the nations of the world to save his people from oppression. Water imagery calls to mind the creation, the flood, the crossing of the Red Sea, and the drowning of the Egyptian army during the Exodus, and the crossing of the Jordan River on the Hebrews' entry into Canaan as demonstrations of God's control over the unpredictable, uncontrollable sea, ancient Near Eastern symbol of chaos. So that, I talked to you about that, like that the sea is like this vision, especially in ancient Near Eastern culture, of this chaos monster, you know, like that has to be in, and even in, you know, like Babylonian mythology, it's personified as a dragon that the god Marduk has to kill, whatever. But that's sometimes portrayed that way in the Bible, of like God slaying the chaos dragon. What's really interesting is like in the first mention of it, that whenever you would expect for it to happen, would be Genesis chapter 1, and the sea is really just, it's not actually able to put up a fight, you know, like it's not even able to do anything in response to God. And so that's really like actually kind of set apart from all the ancient Near Eastern cultures of how they would view the sea and chaos and things like that. So, yeah.
Which is also just interesting to think about then how people would view Jesus and his, you know, ability to calm storms and walk on water and, and things with things dealing with controlling water. Right.
That's very much playing on the motif of the Hebrew Bible of Yahweh being the only one that can call to calm the chaos ocean, you know, the chaos sea. And so, and then you kind of get a really cool picture in my mind of in verse 10, it says the deep gave its voice and it raised its hands on high. And you can kind of see, with the raising of the hands on high, it's like the two walls of water that would be, at the, you know, as they cross through the Reed Sea, to go into the wilderness. So like, and it's even like they're praising, you know, they're praising Yahweh as he's splitting the waters, and creating dry ground as they go through. And then the sun and moon, stood still in their place is referring back to Joshua, and all the things that happened in Joshua and how they went in and took the land. And you went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. And then you crushed the head of the house. And for me, like that has clear echoes to crushing the head of the snake.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from Genesis chapter 3 of the, you know, the anointed, the one in Genesis chapter 3, it's the seed of the woman. But then throughout the rest of the stories, it's like you're waiting for an anointed one who can crush the head of the snake or crush the head of the enemy that's going to deliver God's people. And so, you know, with all of this, I mean, it sounds really hard, you know, like it's, there's a lot going on here that's very, it feels like lots of judgment, you know, and,
but this is really a reflection of times where God has rescued his people.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so like, and again, I know we tend to harp on this, it's like, but judgment is not devoid of, like, they're not, it's not separate from salvation. Like, it's through judgment, like, salvation and judgment happen simultaneously. You know, like, they're, one is for the other. So the judgment of Egypt resulted in the salvation of the Israelites, you know? And so these two things aren't separated somehow. You can't really have salvation without judgment, you know? And, they just have to coincide with one another.
One other thing I wanted to point out is in verse 12, my version says, "In wrath you strode through the earth, and in anger you threshed the nations." And yours, I think, says trampled.
Yeah.
And that word thresh really stood out to me because that's a word that before we started doing these podcasts, I would have been like, I don't know what that even means.
Mm-hmm.
And but now when I see the word thresh, I think about Ruth and how in the threshing floor of this idea of taking the harvest and separating the good stuff of the harvest, like separating, I don't know what you call them, but basically, separating
the heads of grain, like the grain.
What you can actually use from what you can.
Yeah, the grain from the chaff.
Yeah. So, separating kind of the good and the bad, if you will. And so, I don't know. I was just thinking about how God does that. And I think also, you know, we've mentioned on here that I have now watched The Chosen. And on that show, Jesus talks about like how he's going to be the one to
separate it. It comes out in the parable of the dragnet, the fish and the dragnet, where he says, "Hey, you're going to collect all the fish, and I'll do the separating."
Yeah,
you know, type thing.
So just kind of like the reminder, like again, of like he's going to take care of the wickedness in the world and separate that away. So even though Babylon is coming, God is ultimately gonna thresh and take care of it.
Yeah, and so at the, you know, as we get to the end of that little section, essentially, so if we go back to the top where he says, "I've heard the report of you, I stand in awe of your works. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known, in wrath may you remember to show compassion. He's most definitely reflecting on the Exodus narrative as well as them going into the promised land. And he's saying, do it again. He's like, do the Exodus thing again.
Mm-hmm.
And in your wrath, remember compassion just like you did at Sinai. Just like you remembered your compassion for us after the golden calf narrative, remember your compassion now. And do the Exodus thing again. That's what they're begging for. He's saying, do the Exodus. Like, this, you are the God of the Exodus. Do it again. And I think that that's really important as you go through and read the Gospels. Whenever Luke would highlight something, the transfiguration scene, he would say something that none of the others would say, although I think all of them were keying in on it. But he would say that he and Moses, that he was up on top of the mountain talking with Moses and Elijah about his Exodus, about the Exodus that he was about to perform. And so whenever you hear the prophets, they're begging for the new Exodus to happen. And Jesus comes on the scene and the gospel authors are saying, definitively, God is bringing through Jesus the new Exodus. And so that's why, that's why the Exodus narrative is so important. It is built into all of these books, just interwoven into it and saying, I believe in who you are because of who you've been. I don't blindly believe in it. I believe in it because of what you've already done, and I believe that you'll do it again. And so he's trusting in the future of God. Well, we haven't got to that part yet, but he's looking back and saying, this is who you are, and I know that about you. So you want to finish the chapter here?
Yeah. With his own spirit, you pierced his head when his warriors stormed out to scatter us, gloating as though about to devour the wretched who were in hiding. You trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waters. I heard, and my heart pounded. My lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones, and my legs trembled. Yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. Though the fig tree does not bud, and though there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crops fail, and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to go on the heights. For the director of music on my stringed instruments.
Yeah. So we transition. So that last part for 15, is talking about the sea with your horses and churned up like many waters. Again, that's continuing the Exodus theme. But then it's like he hears, so recognizing what's coming in Babylon. And he sees Babylon as the judgment of God on the people.
Mm-hmm.
Through which God is working at his salvation in some way, just like he did in the Exodus narrative. It's not like it just makes him, he doesn't like just feel goodies, like it churns his stomach up,
mm-hmm.
That he can see the judgment coming. But he doesn't sit here and say like, we don't deserve it. Like, that's never been a part of any of this. Like, he's never been like, why are you wrathful?
Yeah.
Like,
because he wanted something to be done initially. Right. Like, that's the first question or complaint is about, like, what are you going to do with your people? They're not behaving.
Right. They're not doing the thing. Yeah. They're not being your representatives.
Right.
And so what are you going to do about it? And so I think we often read this and we say that Babylon was coming to take out Judah, and that was part of God's judgment. And we say, well, why is God so wrathful? That's just never a question that the Hebrew authors have. They never are sitting here saying like, oh, why is God so mean to me? Like, that's just not, they know, like it's something they're like, we understand what we've done here.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have betrayed that. And so the prophets are never like, there's sometimes questions like that that come up, but I think that there's an inherent knowledge of like, hey, this is what, like, we brought this on ourselves. There's never a question of like, why is God wrathful? They know why God is wrathful. And usually what's striking about it is they don't understand why he shows compassion, which is how this chapter started, of like, in your wrath, remember compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it makes him sick to his stomach of what's about to happen. And it makes him, infection enters my bone, which makes, you know, that which is beneath me trembles. I wait quietly for the day of trouble to come upon the people attacking us. So he's now saying, I'm going to wait patiently because I know who God is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm remembering the God of the Exodus. I know who he is. And so I can wait patiently for him to do the thing again. So he's going to do the Exodus thing again, and I can wait for that.
Verse 16, with this heart pounding, legs trembling,
mm-hmm,
kind of scenario, reminded me too of the Israelites in Exodus when they hear God's voice and how, mm-hmm, they were trembling and so, yep, afraid. It's like they're coming into this realization of knowing who God is and what he's understanding, what he is capable of. And I feel like that's kind of the same thing that's happening here, is like, he knows what's coming. He knows what God is capable of. He knows this is really,
yeah,
happening. And then of course that also takes me to like what I've mentioned before, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess. And so that imagery of like people falling to their knees at the, mm-hmm, sight of God, because it's like they can't even stand.
Right.
And so all this is kind of like woven together in my mind and what I'm picturing. And it is ultimately all reminding me of this desire of having people come to know God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was just like something that I got out of it that I don't think I would have gotten out of it.
Yeah.
Without our studies.
Yeah. And so even though he sees the judgment coming,
mm-hmm,
he has a choice to make. Right. And his choice, even after his complaints and the answers that he's gotten, his choice at the end of this book, it's just beautifully put here, of like, though there's no fig tree, or though the fig tree does not blossom, nor their fruit on the vines, the yield of the olive tree fails, and the cultivated fields do not yield food, the flock is cut off in the animal pen, there's no cattle in the stalls yet. And here's his choice: I will rejoice in Yahweh. I will exalt the God of my salvation. And so, like, he's trusting God in God's salvation because of who he's been, not because of the present things that he sees.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I've said this too many times already, but it's not about believing and trusting in God is not a blind faith. People say, oh, just believe, or just, you know, just have faith. And that, I think that that's contrary to everything that the Bible talks about. Like, he trusts in God because of what God's done in the past, and because of what, who he already knows God to be through his trustworthiness, that he's demonstrated himself to be trustworthy, that he can then look at the present circumstances that don't look great and look really horrible and say, I know I can trust in who he'll be because of who he's been, not necessarily because of what is happening right here in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so although the things that happen right here in front of me don't look great, I'm still going to choose to trust in Yahweh, who is the God of my salvation. And he's the one that's going to give me strength and make my feet like a deer and cause me to walk on the high places. And it's just a beautiful end of the book. And it doesn't tie it up with a bow for you either, to be like, and everything worked out, you know, like, yeah, you don't really get that. And I would even argue that I don't know that Habakkuk would ever see their deliverance from Babylon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be 70 years after, you know, at least 70 years after, Babylon comes to town and wrecks Judah. What, it's like 587 BC, and they wouldn't be delivered. You know, Babylon wouldn't fall until, like, you know, the 512s or something like that. You know, like, it'd be about 70 years after Babylon comes and wrecks everybody.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we got to do what we always.
Well, I'll do. Okay, we'll do that, and then I just kind of have a reflection on some other New Testament stuff. But, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So we always, at the end of a book, which this has come much faster this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Because Exodus was our last book.
Yeah.
But we always do what was our favorite part of the book.
Yeah. Why don't you lead?
And mine is actually these last few verses. Verses 17 through 19. And I know we just read it, but I'm going to read it again. Though the fig tree does not bud and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crops fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to go on the heights. And I just, this is something that I really, you know, I love things that I can apply to my life. And this feels so, yeah, I don't have like crops and fields and stuff, but it's obvious that it's just talking about, you know, your current circumstance does not change your trust in God.
Right.
And so as somebody who struggles with anxiety greatly, I have to constantly remind myself of who God is and to put my trust and my hope and my faith in Him, because He has made these promises, and I can see in my own life and I can see through scripture of how He has fulfilled His promises and delivered His people.
Yeah.
And so I have to trust that He's going to do that again. And so these verses kind of ground me in that,
mm-hmm.
Just from a pure anxiety standpoint,
yeah.
of just like, no, like it doesn't matter what my circumstances are. I know that's way easier said than done, but I mean, just to kind of like sit back and go, okay, it doesn't matter what's happening actually right now. God is going to handle everything in mm-hmm. the end.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, that's just really helpful to me, even though there is no, I'm satisfied with this ending of this book.
Yeah.
Even though there's no like, yeah, like real resolution.
It doesn't tell you, and they lived happily ever after.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which it actually ties up really nicely whenever you go back to chapter one of the line of, and the righteous shall live by, and I'll say his trustworthiness, the righteous, it started kind of with the righteous trust will live by their trust in their trusting of God, and it kind of ends with Habakkuk trusting in who God is, even mm-hmm. despite his circumstances. So mm-hmm. it ties up really nicely with the beginning of the book, really. So I probably have a couple. I would say, I mentioned the other one earlier of like, I really love the line verse 14. Where he kind of gives an eschatological or a end game vision of what God's goals are. It's like, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh, like the waters covers the sea. Just a beautiful picture and poetic line that shows, it's like the vision of the whole Bible of what God's trying to do with and through humanity.
Yeah.
And then I would say then the next one would be, I loved this last night when we read it, of in the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. And this last line right here, in wrath, may you remember to show compassion. And I think not only am I reflecting on that from a, wow, you know, this is exactly who God is in the Exodus narrative. Compassion, this word, it's rachum, or rachem. It's the word that describes, it's God's very first characteristic, that he's compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loyal love and faithfulness. And so in God's anger, in his just wrath, he calls him to show compassion on his people, to love them the way that a mother loves her newborn child. That's what that word is getting at, the way that a parent loves a child. Like, remember that love that you have for us. And so I think that's a really beautiful picture. And then for me, you know, like then for me in that line, I'm like, if I'm going to be, emulating and, you know, if I'm going to be emulating who God is, and if I'm supposed to be, you know, a divine image bearer, I know that I do not have a tendency to show compassion in my wrath. That whenever I'm angry, even if it's righteous, you know, I'll call it righteous, even if it's like comes from good places, I have a tendency not to show compassion in that wrath.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's very godly. And you know, just not being angry, is not the way. Like, we get angry about things, and that's okay. But we need to make sure that we are showing compassion and that we're wielding that in the right way, through our compassion as opposed to our selfishness or our, you know, our desire for ourselves, that we would instead, wield our anger with our compassion, if you can say something like that. So I love that little line. So I guess to close this, that last section that we read, 16 through 19, and especially the whole book, as Habakkuk is reflecting on how does any of this make sense? He's wondering how these types of things can happen to the righteous, you know, or that they would be, you know, or what's the line in chapter one? Like, how can they swallow up those less, you know, those more righteous than they? I don't know. For me, especially with this lament, I have to go, and I'm always taken with songs like these or with books like these. I'm always taken to Gethsemane. Where Jesus is praying, and I can hear it. Like, I hear in my stomach shakes. Like, that is the very feeling that Jesus has as he's about to take the cup of God, you know, that he's quaking, you know, like he sees the judgment of God coming upon him, on behalf of the people, you know, because he's taking on Israel's mantle, and he's becoming Israel, that which Israel couldn't be for themselves. He's becoming them. He's taking this judgment of Babylon onto himself. And so in Gethsemane, he's experiencing this very thing right here. Although he may not quote it, the book of Habakkuk, I have to imagine, is pretty important to that moment of the, I hear in my stomach shakes, but I wait quietly for the day of trouble to come upon the people attacking us. You know, and so he's like, I'm trusting in your deliverance. I'm trusting that you're going to take care of this situation. And that's every bit of what Jesus is doing in Gethsemane. You know, he's trusting in his God, despite the fact that these people are coming for him for no good reason. You know, and they're making up lies about him and whatever. And so, and then, you know, this whole line of the fig tree does not blossom and all of this stuff. It's like, despite what I'm seeing, which is the person that I'm saying is the Messiah is being nailed to a cross, despite what I'm seeing, I'm trusting in that God is going to deliver this situation somehow. You know, that God is going to, and he's trusting him on the cross. You know, like Jesus is trusting God on the cross to the point where he said, and he quotes a psalm and he says, into your hands, I give my spirit. That's quoting another psalm of like lament, saying, I'm trusting in you despite what's happening to me. Mm-hmm. And so he's saying, even as you picture Jesus on that cross, he's despite that fig blossom, the fig tree's not blossoming right now. You know, like he's taking on the judgment of Israel and onto himself, and despite the fact of what he is seeing in that immediate moment, he chooses to rejoice in Yahweh. Like, he chooses to trust in him, to where the very words that he's speaking are the words of God. You know, the very psalms of the scriptures, is all of this pouring out of him in that moment. And it's in as he's on the cross, it is, you know, there's no reason for hope there, except that he rejoices in Yahweh and he exalts in the God of my salvation. And in that moment, it's there is where Yahweh my Lord is my strength.